What's up, listeners? This is Jared Holt back with another episode of Shitpost. You may have seen some cryptic tweets from our account. We will be rebranding the show and moving off of Substack to a new platform soon. Keep your eyes peeled for that. Nothing much should change for anybody except myself. Today, I wanted to talk about the speaking circuit of election deniers that have toured the country going to, you know, nearly every state, every corner of every state, and hosting these big, almost like Renaissance fair equivalents of supposed data experts, talking heads that all come together and they all revel in how stolen they think the 2020 election was, even still to this day. NPR had a really good article about this phenomenon in June. They published something about the tour. I'll link it in the description. It's worth reading. And just to give you a sense of like how many events there are, I didn't catch if they had a total count of what they observed. But we do have counts for some of the individuals involved and how many events they showed up to. Mike Lindell, the pillow guy turned election denier, has been to 44 events like this. Douglas Frank, a Ohio professor, I believe he's from Ohio, he has been to 138 of these events. David Clements, a big name in the election denialist scene, 63 events. Seth Keschel, or Captain K, 129 events. Now, they mapped out how often these were occurring, when these people were going to these events, and it really picked up this summer after the Capitol riot. Now, election denialism and, you know, conspiracy theories about voting are certainly nothing new in the conservative universe, but I know I've never seen something quite like this. Admittedly, this roadshow of sorts falls in a gray area with my work. I study domestic extremism at my day job, and while this certainly has some overlap with those elements, it doesn't neatly fit in that pocket, so I'm not exactly an expert on these type of things. But thankfully, I have someone joining me this week who is. Trapezoid of Discovery is the pseudonym used by the individual who will be joining me on this call. I'll be calling him Todd, for Trapezoid of Discovery for short. Todd, how's it going?
Hey, doing well. How are you?
Doing pretty well. I mean, like I said in that intro, this is kind of in a gray area that, you know, comes on my radar in my work, but it hasn't been like a really heavy focus. But I happen to know that you've subjected yourself to like watching so many of these, and I'm really glad you were able to join me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm a big fan.
Well, without doxing yourself, tell listeners a little bit about yourself. What's your background? Why should they trust you?
Yeah, so I've been in information security for about the last 15 years. Obviously, that's a very broad title. Within that, I've done things like reverse engineering, network analysis, application security. So I've worn a few different hats and, basically live, sleep, and breathe InfoSec. I really started focusing on all of this activity immediately following the 2020 election, especially when people like Ron Watkins were posting what essentially amounted to like bad InfoSec takes to justify why they thought the election was stolen. And that's where I really kind of dug in and started analyzing those, putting out on Twitter what the claims actually meant and whether or not they made sense. And I kind of snowballed from there into 2 years later, I've been following all of this stuff closely, and it's ballooned into something that I never really fathomed.
So there's a few different flavors of these roadshows. There is the perpetual, like, Mike Lindell circus, if I can describe it so crassly, where, you know, periodically he claims that he has finally found the proof that once and for all will demonstrate the election was stolen.
There was very big, everybody, pieces of evidence, cyber evidence.
And he invites like data experts and whatever to come look at his proof. And then the conference kind of ends in a fizzle, A, because Mike Lindell won't shut the fuck up and stop talking. But also the data experts that come to these events, I'm thinking, you know, especially of the one that he did, I want to say it was earlier this year, late last year, it got a lot of attention. And the data experts look at it and they go, you know, Mr. Lindell, I'm not quite sure you have what you think you have here. Then there's a whole flavor of like Christian nationalist ones. A lot of these go to churches. And then there's more kind of, I guess what I would call like prominent ones hosted by organizations like Truth Vote, which got a lot of attention recently for its role in the 2000 Mules Dinesh D'Souza movie. I will not call it a documentary. So my question to you is, as somebody who's been watching this stuff, you know, much closer than I have, that's for sure, how do these differ? And does that difference really matter? I get, like, is there a practical difference here?
Yeah. Yeah. I think there is a practical difference. So, and I'd actually say that there's a fourth kind of roadshow that's happening, and NPR touched on this, and to my knowledge, that was one of the first times I'd really seen it given a lot of coverage. But a lot of the events that people like David Clements, Seth Keschel, Doug Frank go to are actually relatively small, you know, 50, 100 people. They're held in convention centers, YMCAs, churches, you know, essentially whatever venue a small rural town may have that can hold that many people. And, you know, typically after they show up and do their spiel, the election clerks in that town don't have a great time. So I
can imagine. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a repeating pattern. And, you know, everywhere Doug Frank goes, hijinks seem to ensue after he leaves. But to get back to the question, you know, what the difference is, I guess I'll start with what they have in common, which is they're all trying to kind of further this narrative that the 2020 election was stolen, and there's different ways that they'll kind of get into to back that up. Where they differ is mostly just the venue and the personalities involved. Obviously, the Mike Lindell ones tend to be more of a CPAC type vibe, I feel like, where there's speakers coming up one after another and they're doing their presentations.
They've even got the food buffet, man.
Yeah, it's like, exactly. Yeah. True the Vote, which you mentioned, they're pit event that they had a couple of weekends ago was billed more as kind of a secretive thing where it was invite only. You had to be part of this, you know, specifically invited. They claimed to have weeded out people that had made it onto the invite list before it started. And then, you know, they have the Reawaken America thing tours, which are kind of the more Christian nationalist targeted events. And I actually, out of all of those, I think Reawaken America and tours of that vein tend to be the only ones that charge or charge at least a hefty admission for people to go witness. A lot of the smaller ones tend to be free. I've seen $20 to $50 to get in. So
yeah, what do the Reawaken America. Jesus. Okay, there we go. How much do the Reawaken America events cost? You said it was hefty.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's upwards of $100. I actually can't remember off the top of my head. And those typically have a large merch setup where you can buy shirts with like Mike Flynn's face or, you know, there's a lot of like QAnon centric merch or merch that overlaps with QAnon themes.
Yeah. Listeners, if you're online enough, you have probably seen the posters for this thing. It's the one that looks like day one, like Photoshop class of like every weird off the wall conservative commentator from Mike Flynn to like, what's her, Anne Vandersteel,
right?
The, like,
yeah.
Bill Mitchell sidekick and stuff, like all piled together in this giant, like torrential, almost like tsunami wave coming over the event details.
Yeah.
So that's what we're talking about here. If you've seen that.
Yeah. That was also the specific event that was kind of at the center of a controversy amongst election deniers late last year, where they claimed that they had been attacked with anthrax. And that was a whole thing, probably not worth diving into.
So we've got these different tracks of like the election denialist roadshow going all over the country, rural towns, big towns, convention centers, all the way down to little community centers and that sort of thing. So I assume they're speaking to different crowds, or do you have that impression? Like, you know, are the crowds meaningfully different, or is it really more of like population size? As far as what you've been able to gather from the crowds, do they seem about the same, like demographic makeup, like same age, that sort of thing?
I'd say there's, yeah, a lot of overlap actually across the different types of events. You know, a lot of folks that tend to hang out on Telegram tend to find this information disseminated on Telegram, flyers for the events and things like that. Everyone typically seems to have already bought into the idea that 2020 was stolen to some degree. Again, lots of overlap with people that follow QAnon and similar ideologies. Yeah, I'd say actually there is quite a bit of overlap between the crowds, at least as far as the events that are open to the public. The other thing I think that's interesting, though, is the smaller events, I get the impression that people walk out of that more engaged, which is kind of what I was touching on earlier. They walk out of there with like a list of action items and specific things that they need to do, like request cast vote records through Open Records Act, requests from their local clerks, things like that. And they tend to really flood offices with requests for materials that they think will help them prove that 2020 was stolen, or now they've kind of moved on to the primaries in some cases too.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that Reawaken America charges a, you know, pretty stiff admission price, $100, that at least to me, that feels like a decent chunk of change, right? But in these smaller ones, you know, whether they're free or the admission is something like $10 or $20, I'm sure to, you know, help offset a plane ticket for the speaker or whatever, those seem to be less like profit motivated. My first like gut reaction when I started seeing this stuff was like, damn, these people must be getting rich. But I don't know if that's like totally the case in every scenario. Besides money, and money will always be a factor because human beings are involved, right? But like besides money, are there other motivating factors, particularly on those smaller ones that, you know, you have noticed over time that, you know, maybe has led to these continuing to go on, you know, at this point, almost 2 years after the election was called?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that recently because I've had the same question myself. You know, why are some of these people years later still pursuing this? And, you know, David Clements comes to mind. You mentioned him earlier. He was covered in the NPR article. He's fascinating because he actually sometime last year lost his job at New Mexico State University, somewhat as a result of the notoriety he gained through becoming a personality on the election fraud circuit, but also because he refused to wear a mask and enforce the mask mandate in his class. And he's kind of set himself up as a martyr type that's, you know, really out there pushing the message of election fraud and trying to get Trump back in office because that's what God wants him to do. And that's God's mission. And he quotes a lot of scripture. And actually, pretty much all of the personalities in the NPR article follow that same playbook. They quote a lot of scriptures to kind of back up and justify what it is they're doing. You know, I think for people like Clements and Keschel and Frank, even if they're not making money, they are gaining notoriety, and there is kind of a cult of personality. You know, they're almost kind of rock stars within that world, and they do get a lot of attention. They obviously get invited to a lot of events. I think Clements at this point seems to be motivated by several axes that he's grinding at the same time, and really trying to vindicate himself. You know, for the rest, I think I constantly try and figure out who's a true believer, who's a grifter. Sometimes that line gets really blurry. I think maybe it's a mix. There's probably not, you know, zero money to be made, but if you can get some fame, get some notoriety, and also make a buck here or two, then that seems to be more than enough for a lot of these people.
Fame and notoriety is almost its own kind of cultural currency, or like we as a society have like kind of trained ourselves to aspire towards it. So yeah, maybe just being noticed, maybe going to the store and having that one person from your Telegram channel go, oh my god, it's Captain Seth, right? Like maybe that's worth it too. But kind of zooming out here, I imagine some listeners might be like, okay, who's Seth? You know, who is Seth Keschel? Which, you know, bless your heart. Who is David Clements? Don't worry about it. These guys have this sort of niche fame, and they're going around trying to energize people, get them doing things that will hopefully, you know, expose the whole election system as fraudulent. But how much like larger buy-in do these events have? Are big names showing up? Are like other constituencies within the Republican base paying attention to this or getting involved in this? Even if people haven't heard of this or heard of these names before, you know, on the Republican side of things, are these people moving the needle at all?
Yeah, I definitely think they are. You know, we've seen people like Ken Paxton, the attorney general of Texas, show up to events alongside Russ Ransland and Mike Lindell, you know, both who have been really pushing a lot of these claims. Mac Warner, the secretary of state of West Virginia, has shown up at several of these events to speak. So they are pulling in relatively big names, you know, from what formerly may have been considered the Republican establishment. Obviously, that's split a bit now that there's rhinos and, I guess, non-rhinos or MAGA.
Real nose.
Adherence.
Real nose.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, real are, whatever it is they call themselves. And it's interesting because they do, it seems like, feel like they're anti-establishment, even though that's not necessarily, I think, the case. But yeah, so you're starting to see politicians, at least at state and local levels, really get involved in this and really push for it. Carrie Lake in Arizona is another good example. She's the Republican gubernatorial candidate for Arizona. And, you know, she's really made her campaign on this pretty much the entire way. So I think a lot of candidates that maybe felt like they wouldn't have had as strong of a chance before are really kind of riding this wave as much as they can. You know, same thing for people that had already been elected and maybe felt that they might see an increase in Democratic turnout or something. They're really kind of putting all their eggs in this basket and riding the momentum.
Yeah, and it doesn't seem to have been like a totally bad bet for some of these candidates. Like in Arizona, a lot of the candidates that have been engaging in this election denialism, showing up at these kind of events, you know, they won their primaries, right? You know, the sniff test happened and their base didn't turn their nose up at it. So, you know, I just can only assume that we're going to see more of this. And given how wide this network is and how many of these events there are, you know, I fully anticipate that this is going to influence things, even if it's just like these people get in a room, see, you know, at these big events, 2,000 people charged up, ready to go, screaming their name because they say these things. 2,000 engaged people is a very powerful thing in politics, right? So, yeah, not the best thing. But let's talk about the events themselves. Like, the Mike Lindell events, that's like the ones that I have always tuned into because they're just like so insane. And it's always fun to see Mike Lindell like start looping. You know, like he starts talking and then like an hour later is talking about the same thing, like he's hosting like a news channel or something. But what are these actually like? Like what's going down at these? And I imagine like different things are happening at the different size ones, of course. But, you know, let's go into the shoes of somebody who came across an ad for this and is like, come on down and learn the truth about the 2020 election. You walk through the door. They swing open, I imagine, saloon style, slam into the walls. You spit tobacco out of your mouth and you say, howdy, partner. What happens then?
Yeah. Which I love that image. You know, for me, as someone that's watched a few of these, and especially the most recent Mike Lindell summit of or moment of truth summit he had this last weekend, I imagine you'd have to be like fully bought into these to find yourself not bored to tears. You know, for example, Mike brought out a representative for all 50 states last weekend and had them do a spiel on stage with him for something he called the State of the States. And they essentially just walked through presentations on what their local level efforts were to, you know, flood offices with records requests or the kind of shoddy math that they've been doing that they claim shows, you know, patterns of election fraud. And they just kind of repeat the same information that's already online. It's already been recorded multiple times. But I guess, you know, you get to watch that with a room full of people that feel the same as you do about everything. And so you've got that kind of like groupthink and crowd energy that you feel at events like that.
It almost sounds like a live podcast taping or something where it's like,
yeah, I'd say that's a,
like, you can hear this on your phone, like, whenever you want, but there's something about being there in person that has an extra appeal or is extra exciting.
Yeah. I'd say that nails exactly kind of, you know, what that atmosphere is like. Lindell obviously has the twist where he always likes to hype one or two things up and supposedly will reveal it. And it's supposed to be a big thing, but at things, you know, like the Reawaken America tour, for example, that it's a similar environment, I think, you know, alongside a live podcast type vibe, but with, you know, extra evangelicalism kind of sprinkled in. And I think that definitely has more of a church feel as far as the way the speakers kind of deliver their speeches, as if they're sermons almost. And you kind of get that whole, like, same thing. You get that fired up feeling of being in church and really getting into it with a bunch of like-minded people.
How have these, like, changed over time? They really started to pop up in the summer after the Capitol riot. I assume that's just when, like, election denialists started to feel not as scared about the FBI coming to, like, bust down their door or something. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, this has been going on for, you know, more than a year now. How have these changed? Have they changed? Or is this just kind of this, is it just kind of like the same shit, different day, different city, different venue?
I think one of the key things that's changed is, you know, the amount of claims that they kind of put out there has grown into a number of options that anyone can kind of pick on as their fraud flavor of the day. So initially there was a big emphasis on, like, Dominion voting machines, but now it's not just that. It's ghost voters, it's fake ballots, it's, you know, pick any number of falsities that are out there right now that people can kind of fall back on. So there's definitely been an increase in kind of the topics they can cover, at least. And True the Vote is a good example of that, with the work they did that supposedly shows, you know, people revisiting drop boxes and uncovered all of these ballot mules. Like, that's kind of a relatively new track that people have taken and has turned into its own conspiracy bubble that people love to talk about. So there's been a real increase in the diversity of claims that are being made. If anything, too, I think people are doubling down on their fervor and really leaning into the fact that they still think 2020 was stolen, and that they, in a lot of cases, still think 2020 can be decertified somehow. So I think that's changed. Otherwise, a lot of the players have kind of remained the same throughout. If anything, we are starting to see some smaller players from states kind of get elevated. You know, one person that comes to mind is Marilyn Todd, who I believe is in New Hampshire. She's really pushed the effort to do, like, citizen canvassing of houses in New Hampshire. And as a result of that work, has kind of seen her profile elevated to getting time on stage with Lindell and things like that. So, yeah, they've kind of turned it into a breeding ground for all of these election denial personalities to have a platform and really kind of enjoy their own little micro celebrity status.
You know, as we're wrapping up here, I've got a couple more questions to ask you. Obviously, you know, just by the nature of the subject matter, a lot of these conferences, events, what have you, are very, very conspiratorial. You know, it is not just, you know, I don't know, that looks kind of funny. You know, maybe we should talk about this thing that happened in the election. It's, you know, the cabal and the FBI and DHS are colluding to, you know, kick Trump out of office. And we either need to go back and fix 2020 or, you know, do things to stop it from happening in 2022. And that has been very attractive to, like, the QAnon community.
Yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
A lot of the QAnon community at the end of 2020 through 2021, really, like, hard pivoted into election denialism. One, Q was gone. Two, it was the flavor of the day, right? It's the popular conspiracy theory, so might as well try to get in on the action. You know, what role do the conspiracy theorists of the election denialist movement, which one might argue is all of them, but, like, the really intense ones, how much influence do you see them having in kind of the broader scene?
I'd say it's it's a fairly significant amount of influence. When David Clements says something, people tend to listen. I mean, he was able to get an entire county in New Mexico to hold up certification of primary results because he, you know, really kept pushing this disinformation that there was fraud in a small county that went for Trump anyways in 2020. And I think to, you know, Ron Watkins, who many suspect may have been Q, or at least, you know, had a large part to do with QAnon, he really pivoted towards election denialism and was really pushing that on his Twitter account and then Telegram after he got kicked off. And, you know, a lot of what he had initially put out there, we still see flavors of those same claims made today, especially around like mass adjudication and things like that. So, when these influencers speak, people are paying attention and they're literally taking notes and sharing those notes. And it's led to a level of engagement that I didn't really expect to see.
So the last question I have for you, Trapezoid, if that is your real name, which I suspect it is not.
It's absolutely on my birth certificate.
Well, tell me this, Mr. Discovery. We've been talking about this election denialism roadshow. Obviously, there's like some entertainment value people get out of this or whatever. But as far as their influence leading into the midterms, why should people care about this? Because I am of the feeling that, you know, the NPR article was good. There's been some good articles about this, but I really don't think enough attention has been paid to these things. Do you feel the same way? And if so, I mean, you keep watching these things. Why do you keep watching these things?
Yeah, I think we're getting better as far as the coverage goes, but I'd agree overall. There hasn't been as much attention as I think we should be paying, kind of given to these events. I think part of that reason might be a hesitance to give a lot of these claims oxygen. A lot of outlets may think, if we give this coverage, any PR is good PR, and we're just going to help kind of further these claims. But, you know, at the same time, I think it is important to make people aware of what's happening out there and how big an audience these events really do draw. And like I said, what's been really striking about all of this is how engaged people are when they walk out of these things. It's almost immediate action. And you can see the organizing on Telegram and things like that, where they put together these coordinated efforts. And it's only going to continue to gain momentum, I think. And, you know, the other part of it is these efforts, by and large, are contributing to a shortage of election workers and election volunteers because of the amount of scrutiny or sometimes death threats or, you know, just having to fulfill these open records requests. It's not a negligible amount of work. And when you have 15 requests for the same thing and you're either a volunteer or you're not getting paid well, you're probably just going to quit. And
yeah, why would you do it? And there's nothing wrong with like requesting public records from
Absolutely.
The government.
Yeah.
That's a
good
thing. FOIA requests slap.
Yes.
We love FOIA requests. But when you're just inundating these election offices, which aren't used to having to answer 100 information requests in a month, you know, or whatever, it really junks the whole system down. And, you know, elections is an area of, you know, government activity that one might prefer not to have a lot of sludge that low paid or volunteer workers have to wade through.
Yeah, it's been really upsetting to see. I've talked to a lot of election officials that have dealt with this kind of pushback, and it takes a really significant mental toll. I mean, I guess on the maybe positive side, I have seen folks on Telegram kind of bring up the fact that, you know, we shouldn't flood a single office with 30 duplicate requests. And they are trying to bundle them up, I think, to an extent. But even then, that effort is kind of isolated to whoever that particular influencer's audience happens to be. So that's not necessarily happening across the board. And then, you know, the flip side is folks like Steve Bannon have said that, They really want to push far right supporters into these election rolls. So as these vacancies are opening up, they're getting filled with people who are approaching them from a very ideological angle, even though it should always be a nonpartisan job. And, you know, I'm really concerned kind of about where that's going to lead as well. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's important that we continue talking about this and covering it. And but I think it's possible to do that without giving credence to a lot of the claims that are being pushed out there.
Yeah, I mean, if I may toot our horns here, dude, this whole podcast, we did not debate any of these claims.
Sure,
They were ridiculous, yeah. Right? So just, lo and behold, everybody, proof you can do it. All right, Trapezoid of Discovery, thank you so much for joining the show this week. I know I learned a lot. I hope that listeners also learned a lot from what you shared with me. Where can people find your work?
Yeah, so primarily, I've really abused the threads feature on Twitter. So I suggest people take a look at my Twitter account, which is @get_innocuous. There you'll find everything I've been talking about for the last 2 years. I also put a website up at threads.trapezoid.news, which collects a lot of my more significant threads between late 2020 and May of 2022. I went through, I tagged them all, kind of put them in a Substack-y type article format if you don't want to have to crawl through Twitter searches to try and find things. So you can pop over there, click tags, look up Michigan, Colorado, whatever, and see all of the reporting I've done on various people or organizations or events. So that's probably the best way to kind of dive into everything I've been ranting about for the last couple of years.
All right. And Sir Trapezoid, I have one more question for you. Every guest gets it on this show. What's your favorite thing on the internet right now?
So I just started playing a new game yesterday called Cult of the Lamb.
What's up with that?
It's amazing.
I'm not the gamer I used to be.
Me neither. And so I appreciate how casual it is. It's essentially Animal Farm, except instead of an animal farm, you're creating a cult. And you get to issue like all sorts of laws and policies, and you have to kind of help that. But then at the same time, there's a dungeon crawling aspect. So it's a lot of mindless fun if you're just trying to stay off Twitter or stop reading the news for a little bit and build up a town with cult labor and cult resources. That's it's been a really fun game. So yeah, it's very bizarre.
Nice and casual. Yeah,
exactly.
I like it. All right, man. Well, thanks so much for joining this week.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.